Shalom and welcome to Nourish Your Biblical Roots. I'm your host, Yael Eckstein, President and Global CEO of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. It is my privilege to speak with thought leaders, authors, pastors, politicians, and influencers about Jewish-Christian relations, Israel, and other issues that are important to people of faith today. And I am so pleased to welcome Daniel Koren. Daniel is a former journalist, an advocate for Israel, and an expert on anti-Semitism who has spoken with and been published in the Jerusalem Post, the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the Times of Israel, the Allgemeiner, Israel National News, and many other outlets. Daniel is the founder and executive director of Allied Voices for Israel, which educates students across Canada about anti-Semitism and unites them in friendship with Israel and the Jewish people. As we've seen anti-Semitism on the rise around the world, here in Israel and the United States and in Canada, Daniel's work of reaching the next generation is so important, and I am excited to speak with him today. So Daniel Koren, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Yael.
I'm so excited to hear more about you and your organization and your journey, but let's start off by hearing about you. How did your upbringing and your education lead to the way that you work today? Can you give us a little glimpse into your childhood and where you were raised, what your values were, if you were connected to Israel, and how that paved the path for where we see you today?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to be brief. I was born in Israel. We lived in Rishon LeZion. But it's funny, I always say to people that I'm from Rehovot because I left at the age of five. And I guess I was one of the lucky ones that my mother was a teacher. She's been a teacher at Bialik here in Toronto for over 30 years. So she had the summers off. So I was able to spend my summers always in Israel. And we spent our summers in Rehovot at my babula's house, my safta in Rehovot. We are Bukhari Jews. You know, that's not something that was immediately communicated to me. And my parents just said, oh, you know, we're Russian Israeli, you know, because they spoke Russian as their first language. And then it became clear to me, you know, that, you know, we don't really look like the other Russians, you know, and eventually I kind of found out this very unique and incredible story of the Bukhari Jewish people. And it's something I guess I really wear on my sleeve today as an advocate, only because A, nobody knows what it is to be Bukhari or knows about that story. And B, especially when people love to talk about Jews as quote unquote white colonizers or European, you know, I love to mention my own upbringing and my own DNA, you know, which has never gone through Europe. Growing up in
Daniel,
the Jewish...
That's a great opportunity. I think most of our listeners do not know what a Bukharian Jew is. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we have the best food, and everyone in Israel knows.
Yeah.
So essentially, it's very funny. Historians agree.
The best parties also.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Yes, we do. So my wife is Ashkenazi, but our wedding was very much Bukhari. And I think after that, all the Ashkenazim said, this is the way we have to do weddings moving forward. If you have 100 people, you have enough food to feed 500 people. Many historians agree that the Bukharian Jews fled and were exiled from Israel during actually the Babylonian exile, and that they moved through Babylon, and that they were in Babylon, I believe it was in the 6th century. And then from there, they moved further east. You know, so for the case of the Bukharian Jews, we moved into the great empire of Persia and the Persian Empire, and we were there for, I would say, probably over millennia or so. And then eventually, they found themselves in the Emirate of Bukhara and in that whole region of what is today Uzbekistan, and you know, to Tajikistan and Kazakhstan, and they kind of developed their own unique identity as Bukhari Jews, where they ate the local foods, but obviously Jewish versions of that, and they developed their own distinct language. And it's something that's very interesting that when we speak about Yiddish, you know, as a Hebrew language that incorporated the local language of German with Hebrew into Yiddish, the Bukhari people did the same thing. And they took the local language of Farsi and incorporated it with biblical Hebrew and came up with this language of Bukhari. So when I speak as an educator about why Jews are indigenous to Israel, I'll always use the story that, you know, you had these Jews from all over. There was no internet. There was no connection. to any of them. But yet this language of Hebrew was so important to them. Today you would look at Bukhari Jews as Central Asian Jews, and I guess we're close cousins to the Kafkazim, who I think you could also call the Mountain Jews. There's only, I believe, around 200,000 of us or so in the world. 50,000 or so are in Queens in a small neighborhood in New York. 50 to 70,000 are in Israel, and the rest are scattered.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, it's a very interesting and complex identity, and we're a minority within a minority.
Wow. So how did that affect you growing up to become a journalist, a very passionate Zionist, and to work on fighting anti-Semitism?
It inspired me in so many ways. When we moved to a suburb north of Toronto called Thornhill, which is a very Jewish suburb, it was funny because I didn't feel like I was Jewish like everybody else around me, because everybody else around me was second or third or fourth generation Canadian, overwhelmingly Ashkenazi, simply because of immigration patterns. And Bukharim only started leaving really at the end of the Soviet Union, at the end of the Cold War. My family was hardcore Zionist, so they left the second they could from Soviet Union, which was in 1976. But growing up in Thornhill, even though there were so many Jews around me, I still always felt very different. And also, I guess once I actually learned about the Holocaust, even though our family hadn't lost anyone in the Holocaust, because the war didn't reach us where we were in Soviet Union in that way, and we weren't affected in that way, knowing, I guess, that that this could have happened to us, and that this would have happened to us simply by being Jewish, really had this incredible effect on me. And then I guess connected me even more, I'd say, to the Ashkenazi Jewish community around me, and then I could recall, I didn't realize a lot of things about myself until I became, a professional advocate. There was public speaking finals in my school, and I always wrote something about the Holocaust, and I always got to the finals. And for 3 years in a row, I did one about the Holocaust. Then I did the next year about Schindler, and then the next year about Hitler. And it was crazy that I really immersed myself into this, because as a Bukhari and as Israelis, we weren't connected to UJA or any of these orgs because we were still like such fresh immigrants, but Israel and Zionism and Judaism were in our house, were part of who we were, every single thing that we did. So I'd say it very much influenced who I am as a person today. My parents very much influenced who I am as a person today, and being that proud Zionist and that proud Jew, but also being a person of the world. My father grew up with many Muslims, with many Persians, with many Georgians, with many Mongolians, with many different types of people, and he was typically the token Jew. And I guess that did have an effect on me in terms of where I am today, running an organization focused on Israel, but also on allyship.
Wow. So you founded the organization Allied Voices for Israel, but before that, you were a journalist. It sounds like you did lots of publishing in high school, and you're very connected to telling the story and researching the story, different aspects of the Holocaust. What was Yes. your niche and passion when you were working in journalism, and how did it lead you to founding Allied Voices for Israel?
So hilariously, my passion was music. Yeah, my mother has been a choir teacher for over 30 years. We grew up with music in our house, and now I have two kids. They are 2.5 and 5.5, and overwhelmingly, I try to ensure that music is a big part of their lives. And I was trying to make it as a music journalist. I guess I was a bit lost in my early 20s. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I guess my biggest passion was music. So the journalism I did was focused on music. And interestingly, as I started writing some articles in the Canadian Jewish News as a freelancer, still focused on culture and music, that's actually kind of what led me into the Jewish world, where I continued to try to have a focus on music and culture, because that was just a big part of my life. But eventually, I guess I had more of a focus and more of an interest on Israel on advocacy. You know, there was a time I believe when I remember when I was a Canadian Jewish News and I was reading these op-eds that I didn't agree with, and I was editing them, and I felt, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I really want to. I believe my passion now is Israel, and it kind of was just this natural progression, you know. And it's funny because it's not until you start doing it that you realize, wow, this was set in stone. You know, this was something I was meant to do. You know, since I was a child, it's been such a pivotal part of my life. Anyone who knows me says, Daniel, number one Jew, biggest Jew. Even if we weren't, you know, religious or observant in the classical sense, but even then, I'm recognizing that I question now what it means to be religious and what it means to be observant, because I'm I'm so involved in this community in so many ways. But it was really a natural progression, I guess, from music into Israel. And then a lot of the journalism I was doing was focused on Israel and was focused on anti-Semitism. But even then, it wasn't kind of enough for me. And that's when I thought, you know what, I want to move into advocacy specifically. And it was at that time I was being poached by B'nai B'rith Canada, which is a very well-known human rights organization here in Canada, you know. So it was a very natural transition, even though you wouldn't quite think those two, music to Israel, would be so natural, but it was.
Wow, incredible. So tell us about Allied Voices for Israel. What does your organization do?
So I founded, and with an incredible group of people, had the opportunity to establish this organization in March of 2023 was when we came up with the idea, and we launched in July of 2023, just 3 months before October 7th. The idea was, because I've been a Jewish community professional now since 2011, 2012, and because I had such a unique, I think, experience as a Bukhari. And in my 20s, I did a lot of work, you know, to put myself through school as a server. And I was always like the token Jew anywhere I went. And I recognized that simply by being a Jewish person, and most Canadians, especially in certain areas, have never met a Jewish person, I was able to educate and correct so many of the wrongs and the stereotypes and the propaganda that people would talk about in, as it pertains to Jewishness, you know. And that was a proactive form of advocacy that I didn't even realize myself, you know, because I was just always, I always wore my Magen David and my heart on my sleeve. And, you know, I'm the type of person that if I see somebody and I'm wearing it, I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to go out of my way to be very nice or very this, or show them, you know, that whatever they've heard or whatever negative things they've heard simply aren't true, you know, and I'm going to make an impact on this person's life. He who saves one life saves the world entire. I really believe in that. And I believe that if you're able to make an impact on one person's life, you can make an impact on that entire community. You know, so it was, again, something I didn't realize when I was doing it as just a Jewish Canadian, as an Israeli. But then when I had this opportunity to create something on my own, I thought allyship and education, you know, are the most proactive forms of advocacy that we can do. And we're always being told in the advocacy space, stop responding, be more proactive, stop responding to every little thing, but try to do things preemptively. And I recognize that simply by engaging in conversations and by introducing the Jewish story and by educating, you know, non-Jews, that is a form of advocacy, and that allyship is a form of advocacy. And I sold that idea essentially to stakeholders, to staff, to board members, you know, who agreed, wow, Daniel, you know, I think you're onto something here. Because I said, let's try to create a movement where we can unite Jewish students and non-Jewish students, so that Jewish students aren't fighting this battle on their own, you know, because overwhelmingly I've seen, right, any campus you went to, it would be Jewish students waving Israeli flags on their own. But we do have allies. And I think especially post-October 7th, we've seen that. We have incredible allies in the Christian community, the Catholic community, the Hindu community, the Iranian community, and other communities. So it was something I felt, we need to create a movement of our own, you know, where we can build bridges proactively and not just ask those allies to stand with our community, but ensure that we are also there for their community, because allyship is a two-way street, you know. And it was from there that we were able to launch this organization.
How incredible. So you've really seen firsthand how anti-Semitism is on the rise, and you came to create a solution, a very interesting solution that's very aligned with the work, of course, of the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews.
Yes, it is.
All faiths working together in order to stand together for the sanctity of life and for justice and for these values that we all hold dear against a threat that's very relevant to all of us. But you have been on the forefront, the front lines of anti-Semitism being on the rise. As a journalist, as a previous journalist, what role do you see the media playing in the spread of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic messaging?
So I see social media especially playing the biggest role, right? Yeah. I very much am a believer in coexistence, in peace, and in partnership. And I look at Canada and the United States as those countries where people from all over the world can come and can coexist with one another, right? And I think what social media has done is it's eliminated the ability to have real and meaningful and nuanced conversations. You know, I don't think we can ever get a real message across in 72 characters or less, or whatever it is. And I think social media has kind of trained us to be in this activism mindset. We were always against something. There's always a versus. There's always an opponent when it comes to social media. And I believe that has now brought us to this new world where we can't get along anymore, you know, where Republicans and Democrats in America can't get along, where liberals and conservatives in Canada can't get along, where Israelis and Palestinians can't even have conversations, right? And I think the politics of Israel and the politics taking place there are its own thing. You know, when people try to have those conversations with me here, I'm like, so how does that justify you coming to places of worship and attacking us and saying hateful rhetoric and espousing, violent rhetoric towards us, Jewish Canadians, right? Whether I support Israel or not, that is not the ideal of Canada. That is not the dream, you know, of Canada. The dream of Canada is that you come here, you abide by the morals and values that we cherish here, and that we engage in respectful dialogue. And even if we disagree, we shake hands and we go on our way. Social media, I believe, has led us to that. And then the traditional media, I would say, has been taken advantage of by social media, because it became to this place where, oh, we have to keep up. So everything is no longer about quality and about researching a piece or about objectivity. It's about who's the first person to run the most sensationalist headline. And because the anti-Israel movement has been so prominent in so many ways, and because propaganda that you wouldn't think would be normalized has become normalized again, we're seeing it come from the media. And it's even the most innocuous things, headlines from certain media outlets. And it's really tragic to me that we no longer have media that we can depend on to simply report the news, give us the facts without any political agendas, and us as educated, intelligent individuals will make up our minds on our own. That was always how I understood the media, but that is no longer the case. You know, when we have publicly funded media here in Canada, CBC, which, you know, as a musician and as a music journalist, I appreciated, you know, for their music, for their taste in music. But when it comes to geopolitics and news, there is a disgusting bias and a disgusting anti-Israel slant, and they are not reporting accurately, right? And this is influencing people negatively, and they are not sharing the truth. They are not sharing the facts. And that's where, you know, when there's something to say to be critical about Israel, please, every single Israeli I know are the most critical people about Israel. There's nothing wrong with being critical. I actually encourage being critical. But what we see the media doing today is engaging in disinformation and propaganda and contributing to the anti-Semitism on the streets that we're experiencing.
So Daniel, you work to reach millions of young people and to teach them not just about anti-Semitism, but you give them the opportunity to be friends with a real life Israeli and a real life Jewish person. And I know that you must face some challenges there. What are the biggest challenges that you face when you do this work and that all of us face while we're trying to combat anti-Semitism from reaching the next generation? What are the obstacles?
There are so many obstacles, yeah. You know, I think going on, speaking to my previous point, it's the inability to have a conversation, right? You know, I think what's happened is we've allowed the radicals and the fringe minority to write the narratives for us. And we're, the media is allowing it, and our society is allowing it, and our governments are allowing it. And what that does is it creates the scenario where we cannot engage. I can remember times 15 years ago, when 18 years ago, when I went to a club or a bar, or whatever it was, and I would run into Arabs, I would run into Palestinians, and sometimes it would be tense, but many times it would be, oh, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Israel, you know, because we all look alike. So people will always ask me, Daniel, where are you from? You know, and I'll say, oh, I'm from Israel. Oh, I'm from Palestine. And we'll look at each other. We want peace. We want coexistence. Shake hands. Wow. Right. And today, just to say I am an Israeli, there are certain people who will automatically refuse to have a conversation with me, who will automatically refuse to see my humanity. And that, I would say, is the biggest challenge, that we cannot see the humanity in one another anymore. Right. And I think post October 7th, this has now affected the Jewish community as well. When it comes to my work specifically on campus, you know, the biggest challenges, there's been many challenges, you know, but I'd say the biggest challenges have been the universities are not enforcing the laws and the guidelines and the bylaws that already exist, right? When we are saying to them that these messages are hateful, that all of this is being politicized, that this is affecting the mental well-being, not just of Jewish students, of students who are victims of terrorism, who have family who are victim of terrorism, you know, students who are Christian are being attacked, students who are conservative politically are being attacked, students who are Hindu are being attacked. These, I would say, are the biggest challenges, that when the universities don't step up, when they don't put a stop to hate fests, to hate rallies, right? The content we see on social media every single day, you know, gets worse and worse, right? And if you don't have the government stepping in and telling these universities, enough, you are not allowed to, students should not be allowed, right, to take over your university to spread their harmful political agendas, to spread their hate, right, targeting minorities on your campus. You have to step in. You, as the adult, has to make sure that this is not taking place. And that's really been the biggest problem of all. You know, our students that are involved with our organization are constantly doxxed. They are harassed simply by wearing a Magen David. They are attacked. They get dirty looks. You know, and again, it's this idea that other students are not recognizing their humanity. And where I think a lot of this stems from, especially, are anti-Israel Marxist professors and faculty members who have now become the gatekeepers to certain to certain fields within academia, where they are the ones leading this conversation. They are the ones saying, attack the Zionists, go after the Zionists. Israel is terrible. Israel is evil. You can comb through their socials. They don't say a word about real abusers of human rights. They don't say a word about Iran or North Korea or Venezuela, but they're obsessed with Israel, right? And this leads to the targeting and demonization of Jewish students and our allies. And if we continue to allow these tenured professors to get away with this, to promote hate, to turn our universities into toxic environments, then we won't be able to get out of this situation that we find ourselves in.
Wow. So there are some shocking and very disturbing things that you said there. And I'm sure there's also a few inspiring stories. Can you tell us?
Yes, absolutely.
Happy ending, something encouraging that you've experienced in your work with Allied Voices for Israel.
So I actually can share so much, you know, because it isn't all doom and gloom. And one of the things I'd say Working with young students especially has shown me that it isn't all doom and gloom, because the students that I work with are so brave. They're so courageous. They put themselves out there. They speak up. And that gives me hope for the future every single day. You know, another thing I would say to your listeners is, I think post October 7th, especially, we've been in this bubble and we have been kind of obsessed with anti-Semitism, and understandably so. But that's also kind of taken away our ability to see the good things that are happening as well in the world. And even for myself, I grapple with this constantly, you know, because I have two small children. I want them to have a future in Canada. I don't agree with this idea that we should all make Aliyah. Everybody needs to leave. Let's leave Canada. Let's leave the United States. I look at that as a defeatist attitude, even though even when I've considered it myself at certain times. You know, I don't believe it's helpful. We have to be strong. We have to be here. You know, so to answer your question, I've had so many experiences with students who have really shown me the light. You know, I can share one example. I can share many, but I can share an example of a student who is Muslim at McGill University, who first started getting involved with our organization and had actually obviously her concerns, you know, about being a vocal advocate for Israel while also being a Muslim Canadian student. You know, and I remember meeting with her and even meeting with her mom and hearing those concerns and understanding, you know, and ultimately I would never push anyone to do anything they weren't comfortable with, but I could tell for her that she felt that she had to. Right. And that she had to put her voice out there and that she had to make a difference, you know. So she ended up speaking at one of the rallies we were organizing. And this was a couple months after October 7th, maybe it was in April, you know, so 6 months, something like that. And the people in the audience were in tears. Right. Because here she was saying, I am a Muslim student standing for you, standing for this community. And I think our community was so traumatized, obviously, at that point, that it just brought so many of them to tears. And following that rally, she spoke at other rallies, at other events. We brought her to speak at the Cumming Center in Montreal to a group of Holocaust survivors. And the Holocaust survivors were in tears, you know. And now she's gone on her own as a content creator, as an influencer, as an educator. I think she'll be happy and appreciate me sharing her name. Her name is Rehana Adira. And she has been a tremendous advocate, not just for Israel, but for peace and for coexistence. And she also speaks about Islamophobia and that anti-Muslim hatred is real. She also speaks about experiences even within the Jewish community where people have thought certain stereotypes about her or whatever. And I think that, you know, is so important for the healing process and for us to have those conversations, you know. So I wouldn't say there's been a happy ending, because it hasn't ended. She continues to do incredible work. But that's been something very inspiring for me. And one other short story I would share is, when we first launched this organization and we have Israel in our name, there were no student clubs, official student clubs, who would partner with any of our students when we launched this in July of 2023. And after 2 years of doing this work, we have brought students to Israel, because I haven't even spoken. We have a flagship program called Common Ground, where we're bringing Jewish and non-Jewish students to Israel to explore the diversity of Israel, to explore the incredible democracy of Israel. And we brought students who are Muslim, who are Black, who are Christian, who are Catholic, who are Hindu. And then they come back to their respective campuses and they try to help find that common ground. And that's why we call it Common Ground. And after 2 years of doing this now, we have student clubs, Hindu student clubs who are officially working with us, Ethiopian student clubs who have officially worked with us, Christian student clubs, and so on. And I believe as we can continue to do this work, you know, the more impact we can make and the more we can nip anti-Semitism in the bud before it rears its ugly head. And that's what I mean by proactive. We're leading a delegation of students to Israel in 5 weeks. 50% of the students coming with us are allies, who are students who aren't Jewish, but who want to make a difference and who want to build this new movement, you know, where we can all see the humanity in one another, where we can coexist, right? A common sense movement for common sense people.
Amazing. Incredible work that you do. So unfortunately, it's time to end, but I would love to hear some final words of wisdom. Sometimes people share a Bible verse that inspires them or a quote that they turn to during hard times. Can you leave us with one thought that our audience should have in their hearts right now?
Yes, my father has said something to me, three words that that are my mantra that I wear on my sleeve. Life is beautiful. And as dark as it can be, as depressing as it can be, as evil as it can be, we have to remind ourselves of the beauty, of the light, of the incredible opportunity of simply being alive in this world, right? We lost so many people on October 7th. I lost a cousin at the Nova Festival. Weeks later, I lost my cousin there, was murdered in Israel after October 7th, unrelated to it. And I spiraled, and it was such a dark time for me. And my other cousin made this for my 40th birthday. It's a beautiful thing. So I have it always in the Zoom. And I try to remind myself, despite all the darkness that our community has faced, especially, life is beautiful, and we have a responsibility, especially as Jews, right, to take advantage of life, to do everything we can while we are here, to be as vocal, as strong, as confident, as hard as it is while we are here, because you never know when it can be taken away, and we can find incredible beauty in life, in community, in family, in Judaism, in culture, in religion, and in so many things, you know. So I hope that is a message that can resonate with your listeners.
Beautiful. Daniel Koren, thank you so much for your time. I know that I speak for all of my audience and all of us at the fellowship in thanking you for the very important work that you do for Israel, for Jewish people, and for everyone who cherishes freedom around the world. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Yael.